row by row, I'm gonna make this garden grow. All it takes is a rake and a hoe and a piece of fertile ground. Inch by inch, row by row, someone blessed these seeds I sow. Someone warm them from below till the rain come tumbling.
Welcome to In the Garden. I'm Kelly Casey, and your host is Shar Shar. How does your garden grow?
Very soggy. Very, very soggy. We were actually going to touch on that a little bit.
Well, it's definitely rubber boot weather. I want to talk about this time of the year is the perfect time to look at bleeding hearts. Tell us a little bit about that plant and why we're going to be talking about that today.
Bleeding hearts are one of my favorite plants. I've been around them since I was a little kid. They are an unusual family of plants. It's an ephemeral plant, meaning that it will die back when the hot weather does come. It's typically one of your earlier spring blooming plants. Just a very, very beautiful plant. And if I can indulge myself a little bit, I want to tell you that if you have such a plant, and an old-fashioned one at that, the one that typically has the heart-shaped blossom, did you know you can take them apart, the flower, you know, the individual blossom, and find all kinds of neat little things in it? Like a rabbit, you take it off real slowly, there's a rabbit, two of them, and then you take off the next thing, which would be the earring, the ear with an earring hanging from it, two of them. And then next after that is a pair of ballet slippers, the kind that hang up on a nail, and they look like ballet slippers. But then you'll come down to my favorite part. It's a champagne bottle. It looks just like a very skinny champagne bottle. We used to take those apart from when I was little on. So see if you can do that sometime and take it apart very carefully, and you'll find all those little pieces.
Well, what a treasure trust. I had no idea. All I knew is that it looked like a lady with some a very large flowing skirt, the way that they used to wear them. Well, tell us, are there different kinds of bleeding hearts?
Absolutely. The original, which would be the very original pink colored, kind of a rosy pink, but they have now since gone into, I counted, 9 different bleeding heart shades and styles. Some are fern leafed, some are the original leaf that you have, but comes in a white, very beautiful white bleeding heart. And then they're in that old original shape, there's one called Valentine. Then you get into the fern-leafed bleeding hearts, which don't have so much of the heart-shaped anymore. They still refer to them as the heart series, but they're in whites and pinks, kind of a deeper reds, and even a sulfur yellow, of all things. I tried ordering one once, but couldn't, so I suspect it might be a little touchy on the hardiness side, although all for this zone, by the way. I want to go over a little bit about the care of bleeding hearts. Like I mentioned, they do die back in the middle of summer, you know, when it gets good and hot.
And if you don't know that, it really panics you.
You get panicked thinking, what did I do? I killed it. But just remember that they do that naturally. Remember where it is. You might want to cut some of the very old debris off, but remember that you have it planted there. They like moist soil, but not so much on their foliage. So keep their foliage dry and maybe just water close to the ground. Also, when you're planting bleeding hearts, maybe for the first time, if you're going to put it under a tree or near some shrubs that are kind of on the thirsty side, you might want to water your bleeding hearts twice a week then, simply because of where they would be located. Part sun, I should say, and shade. Doesn't like full sun. Height can be anywhere from 6 to 12 inches or from 1 to 3 feet if you really got a green thumb. Not a lot of fertilizer needed, I would say. The width would be anywhere from a foot to 3 feet wide. The fern-leafed bleeding hearts might be a little narrower, but your old-fashioned, that pink variety I mentioned earlier, could be up to 3 feet. They get so lush and beautiful. So flower colors, red, white, and pink, although there's that sulfur yellow that I'm still trying to find, spring bloom mostly. And they're deer resistant. Did you know that?
I did.
Very helpful to have if you're maybe close to a wooded area. So low maintenance. I've heard that they're a cut flower. I haven't tried doing that yet, but I could see that would be very beautiful to have that.
Mm-hmm. It certainly will. Okay, we're learning about bleeding hearts. It probably is one of my most sentimental favorites because my grandmother had two wonderful bushes of that, and I planted one and lost one. Mine is growing really well now, and I think it's not something that you transplant often, is it?
Not very often. The time to do it would be in spring. Just divide it, much like you would hostas and so on, but do it in spring before it would get that chance to bush out very much. That's when it would go into steep, deep state of shock. So spring is the good time, but like when I mentioned before, when they tend to die back in summer, remember where you do have these planted. I also wanted to mention a little factoid. They are in the same family as one of my favorite wildflowers, the Dutchman's breech. That's a cousin to the bleeding hearts. It has the same name if you look into the genus of plants. It's just that their little shape is like the Dutchman's pants hanging out on a clothesline to dry. So just remember that. That's kind of an interesting little factoid. Again, when I mentioned the fern leaf bleeding hearts, they have a different color often. The original bleeding heart is more of your green, kind of a medium colored green, but the fern leaf bleeding hearts have kind of a bluish green cast to them. They don't get the height either or the width, as I said before, so you're not doing anything wrong when you have them. They're a little harder to find than in a plant store, so you might have to do a little searching on those. I was trying to find the yellow, sulfur yellow, I think they call it sulfur hearts or some such thing, and I had trouble finding it, so you aren't going to find that in just every location. The one thing to note that they are hardy in this zones 3 way down to zone 9. They are just a wonderful hardy perennial, just easy to grow. Just remember that they do die back. They're just taking a nap. And the different shades, again, they have the pinks and whites. They have only developed those in more recent times. They started out, the original pink ones that both Kelly and I remember from when we were little. But it's a good plant to have. Oh, I forgot to mention also, they have a chartreuse-colored leaf. And they call that golden hearts, mostly because of the gold cast to the leaf. So there is that variety that they have developed. Its flower is mostly the pink color. I don't think they've got that into the white shade yet. So all different shades and colors of bleeding hearts. Some are actually native to the eastern part of the United States. I'm assuming that would be close to the original ones that we had in our gardens, and that's how they developed. If you did want to look in catalogs or go onto your websites to see if you could order any of these off unusual brands, a good company to look at is Roots and Rhizomes out of Randolph, Wisconsin, of all places. They have a very good source of plants and the most varieties that I have seen in any particular catalog. So the one also in the style of the original is called Valentine. It's a really bright red, so that would be very outstanding in anyone's garden that you maybe need a little bit more red. And remember, they do bloom in spring, so this would be a good time of the year to think about them as an addition to your garden. And I'm going to also try cutting them sometime and putting them in some of my bouquets. I haven't done that actually. So, you know, give it a try. See what you think. And they do take up a little space. If they're the old-fashioned kind, 3 feet wide, that would take a little bit of space. But
it makes a very nice showing, especially around a house. But also with those different variations in the foliage, make sure that you have one that matches where you're going to put it. And then also, how deep do you plant them when you bring them into your garden?
You know, you wouldn't want to bury them too deeply. They don't
have
like
a peony.
I would say you kind of have to estimate where they the so-called crown would be on them, but right about at the point where you feel that that crown would be, just put that slightly below the level of your garden dirt, but don't bury it too deeply. I don't think they have that deep of a root system as a peony has, but again, don't bury them too deeply. And they are just really tough and real easy to have in your garden.
Also, can you use like a cage around them? I use tomato cages, but they have more beautiful ones to keep them more upright longer.
You know, I've watched a lot of people's gardens from driving by that have had them. They don't seem to tip over so much like a peony does, so I don't think you'll even need cages. The part where when they start to go into their little nap time, that's when you might need to do a little mending or addressing how they're kind of falling around. Then you might want to do something.
All right. We've loved learning about bleeding hearts.
I'm going to insert something here that I was maybe thinking of at the beginning of the show, but I want to do it before I forget. All you monarch butterfly lovers out there, I heard some disturbing news saying that last fall we had such a warm late fall that the monarchs were slow to leave. And so they may have had a tough winter because they maybe didn't get through the cold weather in time down in Mexico. So if by any means you see monarchs floating around your garden, hopefully you'll have planted some butterfly-friendly plants. Just a note to yourself when you're planting and maybe picking up some seeds at your local greenhouses. Pick up something that you know to be friendly for the monarch butterfly to get its strength and so on. So we need to make sure that we have those beautiful things around, and they're great pollinators. Butterflies, we all love them, and there is a real danger, especially with the monarchs, as far as not doing so well. Their numbers are depleting in recent times, and part of that is to do with their habitat in Mexico is diminishing because they have avocados is the preferred crop. So some of the trees that those beautiful monarchs go to winter over and hang out in Mexico, they're being taken down for avocado trees of all things. But let's go over just what we know a little bit before I talk about host plants and nectar plants. As far as I am aware, there are three cycles of monarch butterflies. The ones we see are just probably stage two in the life cycle of monarchs. And here's how it works. Let's start with their wintering over down in Mexico on those trees. They fly in the springtime down there, what is a different time, obviously, than here. They will start their wayward journey up into the southern United States. There they lay their first batch of eggs, or they lay a batch of eggs, I should say. Those hatch, they lay them on a host plant, which is like a milkweed, so that the caterpillar or the larvae can feast on it and eat on it and go into the pupa stage from which it hatches. And then that butterfly is probably the ones that we see in kind of June, I want to say. That's the batch we see. So that's cycle number two, really, that we're seeing. Then that butterfly, in turn, again, lays another batch of eggs. I should say this, too. It's sort of a sad, tragic thing. But when the female lays her eggs, she dies, folks. But anyhow, so she lays those eggs on a host plant that the baby, the larvae, the caterpillar, can eat from, and then that will go into a chrysalis, or the pupa stage, where it kind of hangs there from underneath a leaf, and then it emerges as a beautiful butterfly in yet the stage three, or the third cycle. And those butterflies that we see late summer, early fall, they'll feed like crazy, unlike the zinnias that I mentioned last week. But they'll feed like crazy for that long, long journey down to Mexico again. And those are the ones that stay in Mexico through the Mexican winter season, I guess you could call it, before they start out for the lower United States. So that's kind of the three cycles that you see or know about. So let's talk a little bit about host plants and nectar plants. The host plants would be something that the eggs that the female butterfly lays the eggs on can mature on. She usually puts it in kind of a out-of-the-way place under a leaf. And let's look at milkweeds. The natural milkweed that, or native milkweed, I should say, that we see growing in ditches is one that they love the best. There's pink and there's white. One is called a swamp milkweed. I can't recall what the pink one is. I think maybe showy milkweed. They're not quite as big as the ones that grow in the ditches in your township or whatever. So they survive on that plant for the caterpillar or the larvae's purpose. And granted, the female butterfly before she dies will probably drink from the blooming flower. So then that would be strictly the only plant that the monarch butterfly feeds on. Now, the other butterflies, the fritillaria, the morning cloaks, which is technically a moth, they feed on different plants, not exclusively the milkweeds, but the monarch is exclusive to the milkweed. That's why there's been such a push in recent years not to mow those down or poison them with a herbicide in the ditches. We want to keep that habitat available for the monarchs to lay their eggs on. So other than that plant as a host plant, let's kind of move on into the nectar plants. When the pupa or the chrysalis stage is over, they form into this gorgeous butterfly. And I want to add in one thing here, Kelly. Out in your gardens, in your backyard gardens, there's a couple of things you could have in addition to nectar plants. Butterflies love to warm themselves in the sun. If you have a flat natural rock, can be a decorative rock or whatever, they like to just sit on the warmth of a rock that's been in the sun and just flat, you know, open and shut their wings. They love that. Also, they like to drink low, not necessarily from bird baths, which you associate with being about 3 or 4 feet high. They like kind of a low basin, or they love puddles. You know, after a rain, you can see tons of butterflies drinking from puddles in the ground. So if you have just a low little bird bath that maybe got detached from the original pedestal, put that down on the ground, or just a little basin or saucer. They love to just drink low. So that would be just two tips. But nectar plants, I mentioned my favorite to give them to drink for their long journey to Mexico is zinnias. But there are so many others. They love bee balms, sunflowers, daisies, the liatris, which is known as a gay feather, they call that, New England asters, black-eyed Susans. They even love, believe it or not, dill. And I've seen that. It's just the weirdest thing, but they love dill.
Thanks so much again, Char, for coming in and sharing her garden.
You're welcome.
And we will talk more when we go in the garden next Wednesday on KDWA.
Pulling weeds and picking stones, we are made of dreams and bones. I feel the need to grow my own, 'cause the time is close at hand.
Time is close at hand.
Rain for rain, sun and rain, I find my